Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to the Daily Friends Show for the new year. I'm Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined for a discussion of the year ahead by Dr. John Endres, the CEO of the Institute of Race Relations. John, very good to have you with us here. Let's start off by talking a little bit about what happened in December since we last put the show on pause. And that is the signing, or not the signing, but the full implementation of the Bella Bill. This is the law that amends the Education Act and will essentially give much more power to provincial officials to control various things in schools rather than school governing boards who currently do it. This pertains to things like language policy, for example, as well as admissions policy. And it's been very fiercely opposed by the DA. It's been opposed by us at the Institute of Race Relations. It's also been opposed by groups like AfriForum. And originally there was this negotiation where the DA said that it was not happy within the Government of National Unity with the Bella Bill being implemented, at least the contentious clauses. They went on to say that, there was some speculation, maybe they're even going to pull out of the GNU over this. AfriForum urged them to do so publicly. And President Cyril Ramaphosa said, okay, fine, we've got 3 months to figure out how to compromise on the contentious topics within the Bella Bill. And if there's no consensus found, we're just going to implement it as is. So there was lots of negotiations. And then all of a sudden, as I was informed by a number of SMSs I got at like 10 o'clock at night from the DA, the DA was satisfied with the full implementation of the Bella Bill, essentially because it seems to me the line they were taking is that it will be subject to what they call rational regulations, norms, and standards, which will be presumably set by the Minister of Basic Education, who is, of course, Sivuwe Gurube from the DA. So I guess the first question to ask before we get into how the health of the Government of National Unity is overall, John, is what do you make of this? Was this a compromise, a sort of clever compromise between the ANC and the DA that will effectively allow the DA to assuage its concerns? Or was this basically a surrender that the DA is trying to put a brave face on? What do you make of this?
Yeah, it seems to me, Nick, that this is not a very good look for the DA. I think the risk has been from the outset that within this GNU, the DA and the other coalition partners are at risk of becoming the doormats of the ANC, being walked over, stepped on, having feet wiped on them and so on. And this Bella Bill situation seems to point in that direction. So I think the DA has been anxious to produce some face-saving communication around it, in the sense of saying, okay, like the full thing unchanged is going to be implemented, and we have to implement it because we hold the Basic Education Department. But we're going to make sure that the regulations and administrative procedures surrounding it soften the blow of the bad provisions of this law. And that really does sound very much like a rearguard action and not a very forceful position to take. I also wonder what would have happened if the DA or the education minister had simply refused to implement it and had said, look, we agreed on the outset before entering into this government that the most contentious pieces of legislation would be threshed out again to find a compromise solution. That did not happen here. The bill has not been changed at all. And we're not able to accommodate the ANC on this. And therefore, we refuse to implement it and, allow a crisis to develop either within the GNU or, in terms of constitutional interpretation of whether a law, once it has been passed and signed into law, can simply not be implemented by the government. But that is not the path the DA chose. It may be that it felt that this specific instance was not worth such a high stakes game, even though the stakes are very high, of course, because many DA voters and some voters who vacillate or oscillate between the DA and Freedom Front Plus are going to be very unhappy with this outcome. But yet the DA might have chosen to not fight this battle this hard, but rather wait for a different battle, maybe the one on NHI, to really stake its place.
So I see AfriForum's statement that came out in the day basically said that they believe that any official who tries to implement aspects of the ballot bill before the regulations are promulgated and the timeline set out by the minister will be acting unlawfully, and they're basically threatening legal action, and so they're doing it. So it's interesting because it's not as aggressive. It's not like attacking the DA for surrendering or something. So they may perhaps believe that this will allow the government to curb some of the worst excesses of overzealous provincial officials, probably in, you know, Gauteng and Pandaza Lesupi's department, where you can see someone going and declaring that suddenly a school that's been Afrikaans and has only Afrikaans teachers will now be all language or something like that. But one of the problems with regulations, sorry, go ahead, John.
Oh, just to say that with regulations, I think there is quite a lot you can do. So in other words, you know, you might constrain the powers of the minister to impose an admissions policy on a school, for example, by saying that there has to be, you know, consultation, there has to be a scientific study, there must be reviews done. So there's a lot you can do to sort of contain that power. But ultimately, I think it's the power will still sit with the provincial head of the department.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the problem, is that regulations are relatively easy to change, and it's the sort of path of least resistance. But you know, you could get another minister. Maybe Ramaphosa will shuffle his cabinet and, you know, send the DA off to another portfolio, and then they lose basic education. And suddenly you've got an ANC minister there who reverses all those regulations completely, changes them. You know, the act is still in force. It's still the law of the land. And so you can't make a regulation that says, oh, by the way, we're just not going to enforce the law. You know, it's kind of, it's going to not survive well in courts, I don't imagine.
Well, imagine if Panyaza Lesufi was appointed education minister.
Right, exactly. Which is not impossible. Who knows what the ANC will do in the next couple of years. But let's get on to that more broadly. How is the government of national unity looking? And I think it's increasingly clear to me that the government of national unity is basically outside of KZN, is very much a discussion between the ANC and the DA. In theory, all these other parties have a lot to say, but a lot of them, apart from Gate McKenzie and the Patriotic Alliance, don't seem to have much of a big media profile. They don't seem to be making their voices heard much. So is this thing going to continue to hold up? I mean, last year our politics changed, and there was a lot of speculation about what this might mean for the dynamics. And I must say, it does feel like there's been quite a lot of status quo going on from the government of national unity. What do you make of this?
That may turn out in hindsight that we're one day going to view the GNU as the biggest missed opportunity in South Africa's recent history, because it precisely did offer the opportunity, I think, for fundamental reforms for the economy to kick into gear and for some progress to be made finally in South Africa. But that doesn't seem to be happening. And the impression that one gets as an observer from the outside is that the impetus seems to be dribbling out of the government, and whatever energy it might have felt initially and whatever desire it might have felt to shape events seems to be slowly fading from it. And if that is true, then that is likely to continue, and the GNU will probably continue going for a little while, hobble along until it finally runs out of steam and stops. And I think that is what it is currently heading to, towards. I think that Cyril Ramaphosa's January 8th statement is maybe also a useful milestone to look at. You know, did we see any communication around decisive action on economic growth, on full-hearted cooperation with the GNU parties and partners? No, we didn't see that. We saw the president saying that the election was a wake-up call for the ANC. They were facing an existential risk. They needed to renew if they were to survive. But very clearly, the president and the ANC leadership are staking their hopes on the existing alliance partners like the SACP and COSATU much more than on the GNU coalition parties. So they, I think, are focused on maintaining the status quo as it was before the election, and are tolerating the GNU parties, primarily the DA for now. But I think it's, the perspective is not really one on building on this relationship, but rather to sort of let it settle a bit and then peter out probably.
Yes, although I must say, there have been some things that I think have been pretty interesting to watch from the GNU, particularly from some of the non-ANC ministers. I'm thinking in this case of Leon Schreiber, who's done some good administrative stuff in cleaning up home affairs. But also, I think the most important thing put forward has been by Minister Malatsi from Digital Communications. Who has essentially proposed changing regulations that would soften BEE requirements by allowing companies to basically claim, work in developing communities as counting towards BEE. And that to me seems like one of the most positive steps that anyone has taken, and it'll be interesting to see whether that gets fully implemented and we do in fact get outside and investment and new investment in telecommunications. Of course, the most famous brand that might be able to take advantage of this would be Elon Musk's Starlink. But there are many others who could potentially also take advantage of it. Do you agree with me that that's like a big deal?
Yeah, if he's able to put it off, then I think it will be. You always look at sort of small policy developments, which seen in isolation seem insignificant, but seen in the broader picture indicate that there is a shift happening. And it was, I think, a good initiative to take by the minister. But we have to see if he's able to carry it through and see it through. If he does, yeah, it could be quite interesting. I also think you're right about Leon Schreiber making a mark on his portfolio, which is good. I think at finance, probably Ashur Sarapin is also doing that. If you read the medium-term budget policy statement from October last year, that really prioritized economic growth very, very strongly. It's really very prominent in that document, and that is a good sign. So if he's able to make his influence felt there, that'll be very useful. And I think that is within a department which generally is quite functional, that being the Treasury.
Right, but I think the so far, at least my impression is that the changes have not been great enough to truly reverse the direction of the country. And I think, to some degree, that was reflected in some of the most recent GDP stats, which were not great, to say the least. Yeah, what do you? The one ANC minister I do want to talk about is Parks Tau. So I believe that Ibrahim Patel, who was the previous minister of trade and industry, was one of the most destructive ministers in terms of the effects on the South African economy with his massive development, trade, investment, localization plans that he came up with every 5 minutes, with his huge numbers of regulations, with his extremely aggressive negotiating tactics that I don't think were very successful in actually developing the economy. He was replaced by Parks Tau, who's seen as a much more sensible voice within the ANC. But so far from him, mostly I've seen things like kind of new BEE regulations. And there's definitely, I think, been some improvement, definitely in the tone from that department. But I'm not sure how deep that actually goes. What do you make of Park's task performance so far?
I'd agree with you on that. It seems in terms of tone, maybe there has been a change. And I think that the new minister is not quite as aggressive as the old one was in promoting his view of correct industrial policy. But I'm also not seeing a decisive shift away from the destructive policy that we saw in the past. And we had the news, of course, end of last week that ArcelorMittal was moving out of long steel production in South Africa. And that really is a big blow to South Africa's industrial development. It is a result of government policy, as well as dropping demand within the economy. But we're going to see more of that if the policy doesn't change. And I'm not sure that that realization has sunk in with the new trade and industry minister yet. And I think that that's still something that needs to happen. And overall, this is broadly reflective of what's going on in the GNU, where there's lip service being paid to the need for economic growth and sort of a grudging concession that the ANC is under threat. But we're not really seeing the sense of urgency where they say, okay, we've got a real problem and it's facing us right now. We've got to do something right now. Rather, it is talking about it, but it's not really convincing. And we're also not seeing the action yet, I think, to follow that. And the consequence of that is, as our colleague Chris Hutting likes to put it, that we're seeing a bit of a sugar high in the economy. So a bit of a boost in confidence, which lifts some of the indicators, which is welcome, of course. but it's not going to be enough to sustain the economy into a higher growth phase in the absence of policy reforms. So those we are still looking for. And maybe adding to that, there are some easy reforms that the government is willing to undertake, which are fixing the infrastructure. So looking at the ports, the rail, right. Electricity and water and so on, which are technical problems, which you can find technical solutions to. That's kind of safe. You know, it's still challenging. It's difficult, but it's not really going to challenge your identity as a liberation movement that is focused on socialist and communist inspiration.
Everyone agrees infrastructure is a good thing.
Exactly. Everybody agrees. It's like motherhood and apple pie. Quite lovely. And so, you know, they'll work on that. That's going to help. You know, having working ports, railway, better water systems, more electricity, that's all useful. But if the policy doesn't change, I think by itself, it's not going to be enough to really lift us onto a higher growth track.
Yeah. Now, even super corrupt politicians love infrastructure projects because, of course, they usually get to skim off the top on those ones. It looks to me like the next big crisis point, I think, in the in the GNU is going to be the growing fight over the national health insurance, which it was the original plan that Aaron Mozzoletti, the health minister, seems to be pushing for, is that private medical aids will be abolished by 2029, I think was the thing. This was opposed also by the DA quite aggressively when it came up in the medium-term budget policy statement in the discussions about that. I see there's reporting in, I think it was City Press, that says that there's a faction in the ANC that's proposing a compromise on the national health insurance that will water it down a bit, which will allow private health insurance to continue, but then also introduce the NHI as a kind of government alternative that will try to outcompete these private ones, which it's all, that definitely seems better. And maybe we could kind of live with that, but it also remains to be seen whether the ANC will actually adopt this. So do you think NHI might crash the GNU?
Yeah, I think that risk does exist. And I thought that reporting over the weekend was very interesting and also encouraging in a way. If it is accurate and if there are at least some second thoughts developing within the ANC, that is a useful thing to see happening. The proposal that came out there was to make having health cover compulsory for people who are employed, who've got jobs in the formal sector. So it means if you're, a factory worker, you're not going to have the choice anymore of being insured or not. You have to be insured. But you would be able to choose whether you get your insurance from the NHI, which is the state-run health insurer, or through a private medical insurance.
And that's a model that's in a lot of countries that have quite well-functioning healthcare systems. I know that Switzerland does that. For a time, one of the ideas behind Obamacare in the US was to try and do that as well. So the idea is what to have people who can afford a medical aid all forced to buy in so that they subsidize those who can't. I believe that's kind of some of the thinking, yeah?
Yeah. So you make the pool much larger of people who are contributing to this. And it's kind of interesting. Like if you're that factory worker, and they tell you you've got to get insurance, you're not going to want to because it's going to eat into your disposable income. And they say, look, for 100 Rand, you can get onto the NHI. Or for 500 Rand, you can get onto Discovery or, one of the private ones. Which one do you choose? Like the NHI one is really, really cheap, but what sort of cover do you get for it? And getting that sort of competition is actually good. The more competition, the better, to let the market find the best solutions. Another benefit that this would bring is also that it lowers the average age of the medically insured, because you bring more people into medical insurance who are employed and who
are not going to actually
healthier.
Be using the systems as much.
Yes, exactly. And so you're improving the risk profile of the insured population, which is quite useful. I think there's a lot of details still to clarify and figure out on that. But broadly, it's not a bad thing. And I think from the IRR's classically liberal viewpoint, we'd say like compulsion isn't great. So forcing people who've got jobs to be medically insured. But I think given the alternative, the NHI, it is something that we could live with and say that's actually, under the circumstances, maybe not a bad way of doing it.
Yeah, I think the main drawback of that would be the fact that the NHI would still exist in the marketplace, which, as you said, you know, it's good for competition, but you know, what's the NHI going to be funded by? If we look at any other state-owned enterprise, it's going to probably be mismanaged and require constant bailouts from the public. So another burden on the taxpayer, which is not great. But as you say, it's survivable, whereas the full implementation of NHI, I think, would probably destroy the middle class in this country.
Exactly. And one concern here would also be that the NHI, you know, if it offers artificially low premiums, for example, if it needs annual bailouts, it means it's going to be able to afford to charge much less than a private medical aid, which has to, you know, cover its own costs. And that is then going to undermine private medical aids because they won't be able to compete on price because they're not being subsidized. So that is a risk that exists in the system.
Yes.
And that's why the way you write the rules becomes quite important. To make sure that competition is fair and it's not sort of,
although of course I do think that many particularly poorer people who might be tempted to take the NHI's cheap coverage would be, let's say, after their first experience with it, I suspect would be a little bit more hesitant to actually invest in it. So I think that on that front, the competitive thing is it's not necessarily the end of private medical aid, even if they can keep offering very low prices, because I think it will be quite a big difference in service.
Yeah. And you, I mean, you've also got the question of transparency over what you're getting. So in other words, I don't know if you've ever gone through the exercise of comparing medical aid plans, not to mention medical aid companies, but it's
I've tried, but not very successfully.
No, it's just a huge headache, hugely complicated. And now we've got another offering, which is sort of state supported. And you're like, well, how do you know if this is any good or not? It's very hard to understand. Yeah. Yes. But once you've experienced it, you know, once you've had a problem and you've had to use the insurance, then you probably get a sense of what you're getting.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. Okay. Let's move on to some other things. We spent a lot of last year on the show talking about the growing crisis in the city of Johannesburg. And I see there's continuing articles pouring out about this. There's still been big water outages all over the city. It pretty much seems a full-on consensus now that everyone agrees that the city of Joburg is in very big trouble. You know, the city of Joburg has not been governed amazingly for, I would say, at least the last decade. But it was okay-ish until around about the time of COVID. And then we had the major instability and then the coming to power of, what does the coalition call themselves? The government of local unity or something like that, I think was the name.
It is the glue that holds everything together, Nicholas.
Yes. That was the ANC, EFF, Patriotic Alliance, and a number of other parties that took over all those Gauteng metros from the DA and its allies. And I must say, Joburg is not doing great. Now, I've moved out of Joburg, but one does have to keep asking the question, will the city be able to survive the mismanagement, particularly the water shortages? Are we going to see a major crisis develop in Joburg in the next year?
Yeah, that's the question everybody's asking. I think that Johannesburg is on its way to being transformed into a world-class African shithole. Because, you know, if maintenance is not being done, infrastructure is not being fixed, and the decline in the city is just apparent to the eye, and it's very dramatic and very terrible. Whether this can be turned around is such a tough question to answer. And one hopes that the 2026 local government elections, which are probably going to be held in November or thereabouts next year, will bring a change. What could happen in the best possible case, I think, would be an instance where you get a kind of government of local unity, but not under the leadership of the ANC, which has, you know, proved itself not to be able to do the job. It's not up to the task. You probably need another party to be in charge of that coalition. That party would probably be the DA. But even if you get that outcome, the scale of the challenge is so vast that even a highly competent administration, I think, would battle to do it. I think there's real trouble here, and maybe a few years from now we'll see some headlines about Joburg being evacuated because it's no longer capable of providing a living space for the, you know, 4 or 5 million people who live here.
No, it is something I think to have some big concerns about. because there's very little, you know, the water has a potential, I think, to do enormous amounts of damage to the city. It's very difficult to get an alternative water source. Okay, let's talk a little bit about some of the political parties. So we talked a lot about the ANC and the DA. What do we make of what's going on in the EFF? We had a senior member of the EFF leave recently in Blozi, who was, I think, at odds with Malema for a while. So it's not unexpected that he left the party, but it really does seem to be kind of flailing in the water. Do you think there's any chance that they will recover this year?
I think there is a chance, but I do think it's very tough. You know, it's an organization that is in trouble, and political parties, I think, depend for their survival on the credibility of their leadership and of their vision. Now, are you able to sell the idea of what this party is and what it wants to achieve? And once you lose that kind of trust and that credibility and the belief in the vision and in the leadership, then a party can fall apart quite quickly. And I think that is, yes, like the EFF is on the cusp of exactly that happening.
Yeah, I think voters in particular hate infighting more than anything else. Your supporters hate infighting if you're a political party. And all the big parties to some degree have suffered, I think, from this. The ANC, of course, has, you know, had infighting problems forever. The DA, I think, suffered from this, particularly when Musi left the party. There was also quite a lot of infighting for a while, and the public didn't like that. And I think the EFF is now in the spotlight for that one. But the other thing, of course, is that the space of being the kind of radical extremist lunatics in the room is not solely theirs anymore. They now have to share it with MK. Which they were probably happy about at first until they thought it through and realized, oh no, these people are going to compete for some of the same votes that we are. Although, yes, that being said, the EFF is, I would say, a much more intellectual organization than MK, which seems to be far more mafia-esque in its sort of mode of being in its internal culture. I don't know. Let's talk about MK. I saw Jacob Zuma was complaining about members of MK threatening each other with guns, and the party seems to be in endless, ever-increasing internal dismay and chaos. Does this mean anything? I mean, my thought would be that this is not a great place to be going into the next local government election, but then, you know, there's some who might say, well, this is kind of how Zuma lives. He lives in the world of chaos, and his party will just go on through regardless. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, so I think each of these two parties faces a specific challenge of its own, and whether the leadership can step up to that to solve it is going to determine whether these parties survive or not. Whether they survive, never mind thrive, is going to be the question. And for Julius Malema, the question now is to stop the infighting, which I think he has started to do, by basically getting rid of anybody who can challenge him, by reestablishing his authority, asserting himself, and sort of dictating a marching order and saying, this is what we're doing, this is what where we're going, and that is how he's going about it. And that probably is, for that party, the right thing to do. You know, you're not going to start with canvassing the opinions of members over where you should be going. It's not that kind of party. You know, you want a strong leader at the top, and Malema is having to show that he is that leader and that he's the right guy to have leading the party. In the case of MK, you know, that's quite a chaotic bunch, to such an extent, as you point out, that even the leader, Jacob Zuma, is beginning to notice and worry about it. I think that in the local government elections, MK is still going to benefit from being the bright, shiny new thing. So you know, it's kind of exciting, and there's the Zuma magic about it, and there's the revolutionary rhetoric, and there's the link to the ANC, and there's this plan to take over the ANC. And that's quite exciting. So, and as things stand at the moment, I would expect MK to do quite well in the local government elections, especially in rural areas, and especially hurting the ANC in rural areas. I think that's what we're going to see in 2026. The EFF, I think, is going to struggle. So at the moment, I don't think that Julius Malema's plan is going to succeed. I don't think he'll be able to turn that ship around. I think they're headed for continued decline. Something that could happen, of course, is that you get a kind of relationship between the MK party and the EFF that is similar to the relationship between the ANC and the SACP, where you know, you get a bipartite alliance between those two. The EFF provides the intellectual firepower, the radical revolutionary ideas and language, and MK is there basically as the big ship that you sail into your elections and try to get votes through. Maybe something like that.
No, I think the problem with that is that I think Julius Malema is too big of a personality to be able to be the brain's trust. And I think that complicates it. I think ideally that would be the best between them. But at the moment, you've got two parties competing for votes. And if you're a far left politician, if you know you want to bring on the communist revolution in South Africa, it's like, well, I mean, I could be in the EFF where Malema will never let me get above a certain rank. Or I can join MK, which is, shall we say, more fluid and dynamic in how its internal structures look. Probably because no one can tell who's in charge apart from Zuma.
Exactly. So maybe we were, I think, designing this as a discussion. So I'm going to put a question to you, which is, do you think that MK will succeed in taking over the ANC?
That is a far harder thing, I think, to do. So I think MK has, my impression is, they've always had that sort of Zuma faction. They're good at playing the internal politics of the ANC. They understand the ANC's National Democratic worldview very well. And so they have an outsized influence inside the ANC, which is why even when Zuma had brought the country to kind of total chaos and had become very unpopular and was creating public resentment against him, his candidate, Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, in the, 2017 ANC conference, almost won. She lost, but she almost won. The fact that she almost won, I think, shows that that faction has a lot of power still. And I think you can see people like Panyaza Lesufi and such hanging out with and backing that faction or backing some sort of Zuma takeover in the hopes that they would be the real beneficiaries of it. Because, of course, Zuma benefits from the fact that he's an old man, which means that a lot of people are willing to sign up to his political program knowing that he's not going to be there forever. In other words, you might have a shot one day at the big leagues. You don't have to, you know, if you're waiting your turn, you know, you're only going to have to wait, well, I don't know, less than 10 years probably before you get a shot at the leadership. I do think that the Zuma people have, I mean, and this is, I think, something the DA should make clear in its pressure on the ANC is MK has been a nightmare internally, as far as we can tell. We've had leaders fired. I think the leader of Mpumalanga was kicked out by the party for allegedly trying to hire a hitman to assassinate someone else in the party. It's Zuma's talking about members threatening each other with guns, I believe. There's just total chaos inside that party. It's a vicious nest of vipers. And many of those members who were in the ANC previously also had those kind of relationships with each other and within the ANC. So the DA should say to the ANC, guys, you can go in with us, who you don't like because we're counter-revolutionaries or whatever, and we can sort of maybe, you know, struggle along to a compromise. And if you don't like that, you can go into bed with them and see how long you last, because I would not want to be in any kind of power-sharing agreement with MK. And I think this is the problem, is that MK just doesn't have a lot of credibility, I think, with the general public and probably within some people within the ANC who look at this and realize that it's very much a kind of a ragtag, take everything that's not nailed to the floor operation. And even if you're kind of sympathetic to where MK is coming from, I think it's just too much. And I think that will hurt them inside even the ANC. It's too over the top. It's too wild. It's too violent. It's too crazy. And that's not really who I think even the ANC wants to be. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm also very intrigued by this question. I don't know. So I think there's several possible scenarios. One is where these two parties coexist as they are at the moment. So they sort of keep, you know, squabbling and fighting each other. There's lots of MK molds in the ANC, and it's kind of messy, but kind of stays the way it is at the moment. Then the second thing that could happen is that, you know, Zuma is successful in his plans and does manage to take over the ANC at the, let's say, the leadership conference.
It's not impossible.
No, it's not impossible. And so you get an ANC that becomes a new Zuma vehicle, set up much along MK lines, MK policy lines, and that, you know, that's the new status quo. A third scenario would be one where, imagine the ANC disbands its KwaZulu-Natal provincial structures because it cannot rely on them. It's just too worried about everything being undermined by MK. Yes. Too many molds, and you can't trust your own structures in KwaZulu-Natal. So they write it off, and they say, you know, we have to get rid of it. We can't keep the ANC in KwaZulu-Natal. MK takes it over. MK becomes the party of the rural poor, and it's sort of traditionalist, traditional leader-oriented kind of message resonates with people in KwaZulu-Natal, in Mpumalanga, Limpopo, rural areas all over the place. And the rest of the ANC reorients itself towards a more modernist or social democratic view, which finds it easier to work together with the DA. So you might get this kind of realignment happening, where MK manages to draw a part of the ANC that finds it awkward working with the DA out of the ANC, focusing on rural areas, rural voters, traditionalist values and policies, as opposed to an ANC which is more urban focused, more aspirant black middle class, and can envisage working with the DA because it sort of buys into the idea of social progress and economic growth.
The ANC focuses more on the townships and less on the rural areas. I think there's two thoughts I have on that. One is that I do think that the more, I don't know what to call them, the more moderate, the more sensible, the less MK faction in the ANC doesn't have a sort of charismatic champion right now. You know, Cyril Ramaphosa's kind of, you know, maybe he's going to still be in the picture, but he's not what he once was. He's, you know, not going to be able to be president anymore of the country. So it's, I think, difficult also then to be president of the ANC if you're not president of the country. So I think that's a problem for them. But I will say that the ANC having a focus on the townships is actually how the ANC came into power in 94. The ANC was quite worried during the transition that the traditional chiefs, the sort of many of those, especially those who had collaborated in forming the Bantustans during apartheid, would resist it. And this is one of the reasons they were so freaked out by the IFP, is they wanted to crush this alternative center of power in the country. And one of the great stories of South African politics that hasn't been talked about that much, I think, is how the chiefs managed to, and traditional leaders and that kind of very rural constituency managed to secure a very powerful position for themselves within the ANC, epitomized by Zuma, who kind of put their interests at the forefront. So in a sense, focusing more on the townships, on more aspirant people, on, you know, the school teacher rather than the farm worker or the urban unemployed rather than the rural unemployed would actually be, in a sense, a return to form for the ANC a way that, you know, the party's actually changed a lot to become what it is now. It would also be a bit of a reverse of the trends we've seen, which is that the ANC is focused more and more on that rural constituency, particularly in a place like Limpopo. Yes. I do wonder whether MK will ever be able to break into Limpopo. The ANC seems ever stronger there, and especially with the EFF in trouble. I wonder whether they'll ever be able to make inroads there.
I think we should watch the local government elections very closely, because that might give us some indication of whether things are playing out that way.
Exactly. So two more questions. The first one, just what's your sense of how the economy is going to perform this year?
So I think we're going to see a little bit of growth, but not very much. So the momentum that we got from 2024, from the formation of the Government of National Unity, I think will carry us a little further. But I don't think it's going to shoot the lights out. I'm not expecting great things from the economy this year.
Okay. And then with everything we've just talked about, what do you think is the path forward in the local government elections? Who's going to win? Who's looking bad? Who's looking good? I must say that this is feeling a little bit like the election we just had, the 2024 election, which is that I get the sense that dynamics haven't hugely changed in a way that everyone is looking a bit weak at the same time. I don't think MK is going to gain a huge amount of ground. I think the EFF's in trouble. I think the DA is struggling. I think it might gain a little bit, but not very much. I think the ANC is going to kind of hold the line, but probably not do great, maybe improve slightly from 2024, although who knows, because local government elections have a different turnout and different electorate. But I don't know, what's your sense? It kind of looks to me like everyone's not in a great position, except maybe the Patriotic Alliance. But even there, I don't know if they're going to be able to dethrone the DA in a lot of places.
Well, I think local dynamics are going to play a big role in different places. But looking at the country as a whole, if you cast your mind back to 2019, to those, sorry, 2021, to the local government elections, and those were already a watershed in the sense that it was the first time, I think, that the ANC nationally dropped below 50%. So that was an important election. Yes. And I think we're going to see a continuation of that trend. So my sense is that we're going to see more fragmentation and probably even the ANC dropping a bit further on that national share of the vote compared to 2021. And then the other parties, as you say, you know, none of them is really making a very strong pitch, I think. Maybe Action SA and Tswane will be able to sell its mayorship, you know, holding power in that city and using the prominence of incumbency to shore up its votes. But I don't see that happening outside of Tswane for Action SA. In Johannesburg, as a Johannesburger, I do hope that voters will express their frustrations with the state of governance. And I think that the ANC has a large share of the blame to bear for what's going on here, has been going on here in Ekurhuleni as well. So yeah, I think the ANC is going to weaken in these places. Whether the DA or the opposition will be able to make hay and benefit from it is a good question. That's unclear to me at the moment. Maybe just one other point to add is just the role of the three metros in Gauteng in the bigger picture of South Africa's politics. So Panyaza Lesufi being an anti-GNU ANC senior member has made sure to exclude the DA from the provincial government and also from the three metro governments. And I think his pitch is going to be, let me show you what I can do without the DA, what wonderful things I can achieve. And on the basis of that, go into the ANC leadership conference and say, I've got a different model to this DA inclusive GNU. Look what I achieved in Gauteng. It's much better my way. And hoping to make a pitch that way. But it's going to be very hard for him to pull off just because the state of governance in these Gauteng metros and Johannesburg especially is so poor that for him to produce a turnaround within 2 years or, you know, the ANC mayors to do that is a tall order.
There was a great piece of investigative report, or not investigative reporting, but sort of eyewitness reporting of a journalist last year who went to a governance in Daba organized by Panyaza Lesufi in Gauteng and just how much of a farce the whole thing was. We did talk about it on the show, but I think, he's going to have an uphill battle in trying to turn things around, particularly because so far it does not seem to have been particularly successful. And as you say, the challenges in Joburg are very large to overcome. Okay. Let's talk about some stuff in the world briefly. I think something quite amazing was the very rapid conclusion of the Syrian civil war, at least phase one of the Syrian civil war remains to be seen. We saw at the end of last year where the government of Bashar al-Assad been in a civil war with various rebel groups in Syria since, I think, 2012. Very terrible war, killed hundreds of thousands of people, chemical weapons used by Assad, and it was an awful conflict that had been frozen for quite a few years, essentially, with not a huge amount of movement on the battle lines. And I think everyone had just kind of gotten used to things sort of being frozen in place. It looked like Assad had mostly won that conflict. Then comes the war between Israel and Hezbollah, where Hezbollah got absolutely decimated in Lebanon. Seriously damaged. And Russia is, of course, very busy with its war in Ukraine, meaning that Assad's two main supporters, that being the Iranian regime through Hezbollah and the Russians, were not able to save his government. So when the largest of the rebel groups, a group known as HTS, can't remember what it stands for, but it's a long name. It's just abbreviated as HTS, which is a Islamist group that was formerly part of Al-Qaeda, but then split away a few years ago to form something else, launched an offensive. They were shocked to find that they were faced with very little resistance from Assad's army. And in the space of a few weeks, Assad went from the undisputed ruler of most of Syria, looked like he was being welcomed back into the international community, had been reallowed back into the Arab League and all sorts of things like that, fleeing the country apparently without telling even the staff in his own office to Russia, where he has been granted asylum. And now that whole country is completely changed and it seems to be heading into a new era. What do you make of all that, John? I mean, it was quite dramatic. And no one seems entirely sure what happens in Syria next. Is it going to turn into another phase in the civil war? Is it going to become more stable? What's the new government going to be like? Is it going to oppress minorities, particularly religious minorities? Is it going to export terrorism? Or is it going to take a more sort of moderate approach? No one really seems to have any clear idea on what the future holds for that part of the world.
I think it's advisable to be skeptical about the prospects for radical improvement. As somebody who observed the Arab Spring and invested great hopes in it in the beginning, I think one does become disillusioned once one sees how these things play out. Usually violent overthrows of governments don't tend to lead to stronger democracy, even when the government that has been overthrown is one that is as odious as that of Bashar al-Assad. But in the broader picture, what I find very interesting is to consider the shifting power balance between Israel and Iran particularly. And I think there we're seeing some really decisive shifts happening, probably far in excess of what, you know, even the most optimistic forecasters might have expected. But we're seeing a very significant weakening of Iran's role in the region because its proxies are so heavily weakened by Israeli action. And that would include Hamas, it includes Hezbollah, it includes Syria as well. All of these places, you know, which were sort of the proxies of Iran, are severely weakened. And I think Iran itself is also undergoing considerable strain economically currently, as well as reputationally, because it has suffered so many setbacks. That process, I think, could well continue. And that is because I don't think that Israel is going to let up on the pressure. I think they're going to continue. And I think that the United States, under a Trump presidency, is also not going to be very indulgent or very accommodating of regimes such as that of Iran. So I think the pressure is going to be kept up, maybe stepped up, and Iran is going to battle to reassert its authority. Whether that spells good news for the Middle East is an open question, I think, because the risk, of course, is that it just generates instability and you know, factions and faction fighting spilling out from one country to the next and engulfing the entire region in conflict and civil wars and so on. That might happen. Of course, we might also get a more positive outcome where we see a bit of more stabilization and maybe an accommodation of the Muslim world's relationship with Israel that allows for some form of coexistence that is not as hostile and belligerent as it has been for the past decades.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I would like to say that, you know, Syria is important. I mean, the civil war there was a big part of the big migrant crisis that hit Europe.
That's right.
So it's not something that can, you know, these things happen. You think, oh, it's a troubled country. It's been a dictatorship forever. It's got a civil war, so what? Well, these things always have a kind of big knock-on effect far beyond their borders. It does seem like the kind of one of the winners here was Turkey, who backed the rebel group that's become the primary one to take over the government in Syria now, HDS. And it's going to be interesting to see how they play their hand now. But as you say, you know, Iran seems to be the big loser here, suffering all over the Middle East. Its main ally in Gaza, Hamas, has been really heavily hit. Hezbollah's leadership has been killed. Hamas's leadership has been killed. The Houthis, who are the Iranian proxy in Yemen, who are attacking shipping in the Red Sea, have been seriously damaged both by Israeli airstrikes as well as by attacks by an international coalition led by the Americans. And it also seems now like that civil war has a potential to restart as well. It's also a frozen conflict where the Saudi-backed government in Yemen might fight against Iran's proxies there again. It seems like Iran's only firm ally still left in the region is its control it exerts over Iraq, which is also a little bit shaky from time to time. So I think that that's a country that's really in a bit of crisis right now. So it's no surprise that when you have the prospect of the Trump administration coming in, who's promised to be tough on Iran, that there are these reports that Iran was playing around with the idea of trying to assassinate Trump, which doesn't seem like it would be, you know, that doesn't seem like the kind of thing that America could ignore, regardless of who the president was. But anyway.
Yeah, I think it's sort of a sign of desperation to try a stunt like that, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe one thing we should also keep an eye on is that I think the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and other Iranian government entities have also been involved in assassinations and terrorism outside of Iran. Sort of, you know, going after dissidents and people reporting unfavorably on the regime, assassinating them, attacking them, et cetera, and I think that we're going to see some decentralized counters to that. So I read that there's a task force being set up, a counterterrorism task force, which I think is going to go after these kind of activities and try to curtail them. So it'll be another area where Iran is going to be under pressure, being countered at every turn, and finding the space to move and act more constrained every day.
And up till now, Iran has been very much propped up by both China and Russia, especially China, who's invested heavily in its economy and continues to buy its oil, I believe.
MTN also has a big investment in Iran, so I wonder what's going to happen to that.
Yes, no, it's something. That's how it could affect us here quite directly, I think. Let's move closer to home. Mozambique has been in a state of chaos now for some time after a disputed election, where it looked like there may well have been significant fraud in the election of the Frelimo government in Mozambique. Very large protests against the government. They don't seem to have been able to crystallize into, from my understanding of it, of a very direct, organized, focused political movement. But there's very significant resistance there to the government, lots of riots, protesters being run down by police trucks in Mozambique. I've seen footage of that. I've seen protesters chasing away government officials from the border post at one point. South Africa had to close one of its border posts with Mozambique because the protesters had essentially taken it over. A lot of instability and chaos there. We don't know how it's going to end. The opposition leader who claims to have won the election has just returned to the country after fleeing into exile. So maybe that will help catalyze a political movement against Frelimo there. But it really seems a lot like the Southern African Development Community, SADC, which is kind of the main regional organization that South Africa and Mozambique and Zimbabwe, all these countries around us belong to, has had absolutely no idea how to deal with this chaos in Mozambique. And this could be a big problem. Mozambique is already a very poor, very unstable place. If it gets worse, or God forbid, falls into a civil war or something like that, the knock-on effects in South Africa are going to be quite severe, I think.
Yeah, so the conflict there is continuing, but I think that in the end, the government is probably going to be able to hold its breath for longer, if you want to put it that way, just because it has more resources. And my suspicion is that the protests are going to run out of steam at some point, and the suppression by the government is just going to be harsh and successful, unfortunately. Rectifying a rigged election result, as is claimed to be the case in Mozambique, it's very, very difficult when the regime in charge is willing to use violence and force to keep itself in power, in addition to fraud and manipulation. It's a bit similar to the situation in Venezuela, which had its own elections last year. I thought they were quite well organized because they got copies of all the tally sheets from polling stations. So they've got physical evidence of the opposition having won the election. But even with that physical evidence, they haven't been able to dislodge Nicolas Maduro and his government from power. They still keep on trying to do so. But in Mozambique, as far as I know, the opposition doesn't have that physical evidence. So it's sort of a case of assertions and claims and, you know, trying to create pressure. But it's going to be very difficult for them to make it stick. As you point out, it has knock-on effects on our country, on South Africa, because given the shortcomings of our own ports, we've been exporting more and more of our goods through Mozambique, through the port of Maputo, which is by all accounts working better than our own ports. But that transport route, of course, is affected by protests and suppression by the government. South Africa has an interest in instability in Mozambique. But I think that much as is the case with Zimbabwe, as long as the South African government does not commit itself to democracy and free elections, but is willing to turn a blind eye to manipulation, rigging, and violence, as long as that is the case, the situation in those countries won't improve, ultimately to the detriment of South Africa itself.
Of course, and the potential for large numbers of people coming here, fleeing a war there maybe, or even just chaos and instability, is not something to be discounted. What else is going on in the world? We've seen Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, seeming to do a little bit of a turnaround in how Facebook operates. Facebook has been very keen on the whole sort of professional fact-checker industry. It was using them to determine whether posts would be allowed or noted or whatever on Facebook. Facebook also had very strict guidelines for what content you would be allowed to post on the platform. And with the election of Donald Trump, Zuckerberg seems to have reversed course on this. He's now said that they're going to implement a sort of community-focused system similar to X's community notes system on posts on Facebook to counter, you know, lies and misinformation and, you know, false claims, that sort of thing. And he's, you know, kind of doing the circuit on the sort of the kind of right-leading media space, talking up Facebook and talking about a big change in the policies there. What do you make of this? I mean, it does seem like Zuckerberg is a little bit, to me, blows like a bit of a sort of leaf in the wind here. After the election of Trump in 2016, when there was a lot of political angst on the left about the role Facebook had allegedly played in his election, suddenly Facebook fell over itself to regulate everything and control political speech and do this and do that. And Zuckerberg went before hearings and talked about, you know, Facebook's neutrality and how wonderful it was. And now that it looks like the right is on ascendance in America, suddenly Zuckerberg emerges as a champion of free speech on the right. I don't know. I don't take it particularly seriously, but maybe I'm just too cynical.
So my impression is that Zuckerberg and sort of Facebook, to some extent, did not join in the orgy of censorship for reasons of principle, but rather for reasons of lack of principle. So in other words, they would have gone along with requests to, you know, correct certain misinformation and to remove some posts that were contrary to whatever guidelines they have, et cetera, and were then escalated into a state of doing that more and more until they became very deeply embedded in that kind of right-thinking complex, the left-right-thinking complex, I mean. However, one argument why Zuckerberg's change of heart might be more than sheer opportunism is that I think we have seen a change in his personal behavior, probably dating to 2023 or thereabouts, so predating the election, the American election, where he started becoming quite involved in physical training, combat sports, and he seemed to change his personality almost. And an acquaintance of mine once put it to me that the election, the Democrats in the United States were supported mainly by weak women, weak men and angry women. A very dismissive comment, of course. But I wonder if Zuckerberg, even prior to the election, transitioned. So whether Zuckerberg, even prior to the election, transitioned from being a weak man to becoming a strong man, and so was already prepped for a Trump presidency and basically ready to step over the line start championing free speech rather than right thinking. Maybe
sort of an interesting sociological point there, that the outsized influence that MMA, mixed martial arts fighting stuff, has over the modern American right. It's not something I think I would have expected 10 years ago, but it's kind of interesting to watch from a sort of sociological perspective.
Yeah, and I think it's important. You know, it's, I think it's significant. And it's significant in the sense that Mike Tyson, most famous aphorism, I think, is everybody's got a plan until you punch them in the face. And this MMA orientation, I think, is people coming to grips with reality in a very tangible way. You know, you can't theorize your way out of personal combat with another person in a small space. It's very hard. It's very concrete.
If I may throw out another wild theory, I think this is a, you know, for a long time we've kind of looked at politics as being very tied to your geographic location, your race, your religion, your gender, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think the internet age is creating new communities that can't easily be seen, mostly because they're not geographically focused. And the sort of fighting community in the US, I think, is one of these communities that is created entirely by a shared interest in sport that's drawn together across the whole country and the whole world to a degree. And it has a culture, it has values, it has a viewpoint. That's the kind of predominant view in that. It's not just a sport. It's actually much bigger than that. And that is beginning to impact in you know, politics larger. And I think that this is, to some degree, a technologically driven change, that the internet is changing the way that society and politics works, which is that, you know, it's not about a neighborhood banding together. It's about a community created by shared interests banding together to enact their vision. I don't know. What do you make of that?
I think it's probably, it's still quite US focused, but not entirely. You know, so we know Dricus du Plessis is involved in the sport. We've got a famous Irish champion. The Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu community, I think, has been quite foundational to it. So yeah, it is quite international. And maybe you're right about that. It's, I think, also a community that positions itself very consciously in contradistinction to the sort of the prevailing left-wing orthodoxy. It is, I think, in many ways quite right-wing or conservative. And it explicitly wants to be so.
Countercultural.
Counterculture, yeah, exactly. It's a counterculture movement, yeah. So very interesting.
Okay, I think for our last question, we're just going to talk, of course, about the continuing conflict in between Ukraine and Russia. It's a difficult war to sort of sum up, but it looks like at the moment Ukraine is really struggling militarily on some fronts. It's having manpower shortages. It's having disputes and questions with some of its allies as to whether aid will continue to it at the levels that have been. There's promises by the Trump administration that he's going to force some kind of peace agreement. Originally, it was before he took office. Then it was on the first day he took office, and now his envoy on the conflict, Keith Kellogg, is talking about the conflict being resolved within the first 100 days of his administration. And I think part of that is just to do with the fact that this is a very serious, high-stakes conflict for both of the main participants. Both Ukraine and Russia see this as a very big deal that, you know, will impact them going forward. So I'm skeptical that the conflict will end this year. Maybe it will be if one side loses, but I think that it's still probably going to drag on into 2026. I don't know. Maybe I'm just too pessimistic. What do you think?
I'm not sure. You know, I wonder if Ukraine will be able to hold out for much longer, or if maybe, you know, it's sort of close to reaching the end of its road, in which case it probably will look for negotiations. And I think typically these kinds of conflicts end once one side decides that it cannot improve its position further by continuing to fight. And, you know, both Russia and Ukraine might be arriving at that point, where Ukraine says, look, you know, we've lost territory, we've tried to get it back, that hasn't really worked, we're kind of stuck. And Russia says, you know, we've been engaged in this conflict, it's been quite expensive. I believe the Russian government is dedicating 40% of its budget to military expenditure. It's going to, you know, depress its ability to spend on other government activities. So the Russian economy is also going to be under pressure. And maybe they've now reached the point where neither of them can really improve their position by keeping on fighting. And if that is the case, then I think they are going to be open to negotiating some sort of stalemate truce, maybe even a peace, which I think from the Ukrainian side is going to be unsatisfactory, and the Russians might be happy with the deal they get. I think for the Ukrainians, probably the key thing is going to be to get some security guarantees from larger powers to protect them from further predations by the Russian state.
I think that there's still a lot in the air, and anyone who says that this is clearly going to end in one way or another, I think is not necessarily being accurate. So I don't think it's clear yet how this is going to all end up. Okay, that is, I think, all we're going to talk about today. Please, in the comments below, leave your thoughts about what issues you think are going to be a big deal this year, if you think there's anything we missed or anything you want to talk about. I also encourage you to subscribe if you enjoyed the show. John, thank you very much for being on the show. We shall see you tomorrow when the normal Daily French show shall resume programming.